Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 11th of August, 2021, and this is Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, and him, Phil Bishop, from the Construction Index. And being British, Phil, I thought that today we'd just talk about the weather. Well, the climate, the climate.
I'm back in short trousers. They've been away for about at least a fortnight, if not a month. We seem to have... I thought summer had ended long ago, and now it's back. Some global warming happening again. Lovely.
Wow. Not down here it isn't, but anyway. So, yeah, there's been a lot of climate around for the last week or so, hasn't there?
Actually, I shouldn't joke about global warming. Yes. Talking of climate, the big story of the week, of course, is Greta Thunberg on the front cover of Vogue Scandinavia. Launch issue of Vogue Scandinavia's got Greta on the cover, which was lovely to see.
I didn't know you took Vogue, but there we are.
But no, that's not the biggest story in the world of climate change. Of course, I'm sure listeners cannot have missed the fact that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has published its fifth report, I think.
Sixth.
And it makes very sober reading. I won't pretend to have read the whole thing, but I've read the, you know, introductions, conclusions, summaries, and so on. And... I don't think we need to go through the detail. In fact, there's nothing there I don't think...
We all know the details, don't we? I mean, there's nothing new there.
No. I think what seems to be new is that 195 governments of the United Nations have all said, yep, this is our... You know, we support this, and it's... I don't know how many dozens or hundreds of top scientists from around the world have put their name to it and been involved in this. And it's basically the latest... assessment of the scientific evidence of what's going on, and you know, the opening statement, it is unequivocal that human influence has warmed the atmosphere, ocean and land. In other words, global warming, for a while a lot of people said, oh, it's not happening, and then I think it became universally pretty much accepted that global warming was happening, but still many people thought that it was just a natural cyclical thing, mm-hmm. that the globe warms and cools over time, and that, you know, the ice age was not man-made, and these things happen. But all these scientists are saying there's absolutely unequivocally human influence on it. Whether things might be happening without human influence, I don't know, doesn't say. But there's definitely humans are making bad things happen. The good news is that we can take action. There are things that we can do to mitigate this. Again, we know all about it. So the whole drive to net zero.
But I found this very frustrating, actually, because there was a great hoo-ha about the report. And as you say, it was on every news bulletin. And everybody was talking about it, but nobody was saying anything that I hadn't heard already before. And this was a frustrating thing. I had a sort of a deluge of press releases into my inbox, all saying nothing. I mean, nobody said anything. Literally, some of them said nothing. They just said, oh, you know, this is a wake-up call, and that's about as far as their argument went. The UK Green Building Council went a little bit further, and... Well, I don't really think they said an awful lot more. The only thing that they said that I didn't already know was that about 21 or 22% of the total UK carbon emissions were directly controlled by the built environment sector. Well, I thought that was a new factoid that I hadn't seen before. But everybody else said nothing.
How do you define... I don't understand how they define what the built environment sector is, because Heathrow Airport is a part of the built environment. So do we count aeroplanes taking off and landing, but stop counting them when they get a mile away from Heathrow Airport?
I don't know. No, I don't think so. I think that you can separate air travel from the built infrastructure at airports. Quite honestly, don't understand how a lot of this stuff is measured or quantified. I mean, I suppose, because of course we've got the COP26 conference taking place in Glasgow in November.
Well, that's the context. That's what this is all about. It's setting a political impetus behind it to get something done.
So I read this report. I didn't read the report. I read news of the report as a sort of a teaser, you know, a sort of a an official trailer for COP26. Because it was basically restating stuff that we knew. But as you pointed out just now, it said that everybody, all the UN, United Nations governmental representatives are in full agreement on this. So it was a sort of gathering of the clans, I suppose, ready for Glasgow in November. So, yeah, it's a very serious topic. But I don't know, I detected a lot of hot air, which... no pun intended there, I thought was not particularly helpful. I suppose it's a rallying cry, so perhaps that's where the value lies.
Well, there's an awful lot of it's sort of global, and I was going to use the word propaganda, but that suggests that I don't believe it. I don't mean that. But we know that if we are going to get to net zero by 2030 or 2050 or whatever the government's ambition is, we're all going to have, we've talked about this many times, heat pumps, and it's going to cost us a lot of money. We're going to have to spend money, all of us, and taxes are going to have to go up. It's going to be hugely expensive. And no government around the world is comfortable spending huge sums of money unless it's got its electorate, and we're talking democracies here, I guess. They're not all democracies.
Sure, yes.
But if you've got to stand for election, you want the people who are voting for you to understand why you're spending billions on environmental mitigation measures and to support it. So it's almost like a United Nations, you know, governments of the world uniting to indoctrinate the people
of
the
world. It's a hearts and minds thing, isn't
it? Yes, on a global level.
And... I think that's right. I think that's a good point, actually, which I haven't heard anybody make before, the fact that, you know, you're going to have to shell out for this, and so you've got to soften, you know, you've got to sweeten the pill, haven't you? I said that nobody had anything to say. Well, I didn't actually say that nobody had anything to say, but what they said was pretty meaningless. AECOM, the consulting... Is AECOM a consulting engineer still, or do they do more than that? But anyway, they said that it's no longer enough for organisations to set ambitious net zero targets without a clear pathway to how to achieve them, which I found quite alarming, because it seems to... it presupposes that everybody has been setting these ambitious net zero targets without any idea about how they're going to achieve them, which is... bloody stupid. If that's true, then I think people should be ashamed of themselves. I mean, AECOM said this, I think, in order to then reveal that they've signed up to this thing called science-based targets, which is all the rage at the moment. I don't know if you've encountered this, but there's actually an organisation called Science-Based Targets. In fact, there is an article coming out in next month's magazine, Construction Index magazine, describing how one of the UK's materials producers has signed up to these science-based targets. And what it is basically what people should have been doing in the first place, which is setting themselves targets which are informed by scientific evidence. The whole thing points to the fact that people have just been doing this blindly without knowing why they were doing it, but not how they're going to do it, which is a bit alarming, because, you know, this is a call to action, this COP26 thing and the sixth assessment report of the IPCC. But if people have been sort of running around like headless chickens, setting themselves unrealistic targets without any idea about how they're going to achieve them, then we should all be scared, because what that boils down to, as far as I can tell, is that we're not going anywhere. We're terrified of what's happening, but we're not doing anything actually to solve the problem. So maybe this is it. We've got to get our act together and start crunching the numbers and decide, you know, getting ourselves a clear pathway to, you know, net zero or zero carbon, whatever you like.
But that AECOM quote you mentioned, it talks about the need for, you know, industry collaboration. I think that's absolutely part of it, or key to it. Because if you're, you know, Johnny or Jenny building contractor, there's limited amount that you yourself can do to reduce your carbon footprint, you are mostly dependent on the people who supply your materials, that there's mm-hmm. less packaging and there's less carbon in the materials that you're building with, that your machinery used is electric powered rather than, you can make the choice to buy electric powered machinery, but it needs to be available and effective and productive and so on. And you are not at the mercy of, but it's your supply chain and your electricity supplier needs, you need to be trusting the fact or driving the fact that they're getting their fuel from renewable sources and not from coal-fired power stations or whatever, although they seem to be. Do we have any coal-fired power stations left? They all seem to be on their way out, don't they? But
I don't know, actually. There might be one or two lurking somewhere, I don't know.
Your day-to-day building contractor is, as I say, is dependent on the people that supply them with their materials, machinery and power and so forth.
Yeah, I suppose the message is you can't do it alone. I mean, it has to be a united front. It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because it does require cooperation and collaboration and coordination right across the board. So, maybe this is why people have been running around like headless chickens, because they know they can't do it on their own. But we've had the science for a long time now. Surely, people should have applied it and used that evidence to set their own targets. That's really my point here. I think that when the COP conference takes place, the COP26 conference takes place in Glasgow, I'm hoping that we're going to hear a lot more stuff that, a bit more light and less heat, if you like, that there'll be more sort of solid evidence that we can work on.
But there's never going to be, it seems to me, a great leap forward in this. It is all incremental changes, this accumulation of small changes. Governments may suddenly crank up the targets that we've seen in recent years, where they, instead of being net zero in 50 years, we've got to get there in 10 years, or petrol cars much sooner than previously done. I mean, all these targets are being pulled down quite dramatically, brought closer to us quite dramatically. But in terms of the science and the technology, I think the technology is moving faster than the science, actually. Some of the speed with which alternative fuels and alternative, whether it's the Tesla cars and so on, they seem to have become mainstream much more quicker than I ever thought they would have been.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned Tesla, because I was having a conversation with a friend last night, actually, about electric cars. And I mentioned the fact that actually you see a lot of Teslas on the road, even down here in sleepy Devon. There's quite a few of them around. And my friend was saying that actually he thought that we've got it wrong. These are big cars. He said, Teslas are big cars. They're not small. They're big and heavy. And he said they're still... We should be rethinking the whole way that we literally go about the country, not in big cars, but in smaller electric cars. And I suddenly realised that, without actually realising it himself, he was talking about the Sinclair C5.
Well, it'd be okay for me. If we were all in a Sinclair C5, it'd be fine. The danger is when you mix Sinclair C5 with proper big motor cars.
Yeah, yeah.
Not so safe.
Yeah. Well, I think Clive, I'm sure that a lot of our younger listeners won't even know who Clive Sinclair was, but he was a very, very clever man who had some wonderful ideas and basically invented the pocket calculator back in the 1970s. And he had great ideas, but none of his products were particularly good. I mean, I'm probably being unfair to him. But the C5 was heralded, this is back in the 70s, late 70s. It was heralded as, the first electric car. So these things aren't new. Tesla actually looks like a car, but Sinclair 5 didn't when it was finally revealed. And it looked like a sort of a...
soapbox.
A rather large plimsoll. It looked like a plimsoll. You sat in this thing and you whizzed around at no more than about 10 miles an hour, which is very disappointing to everybody concerned. But we've come a long way since then. But that was a diversion, not necessarily a helpful diversion. But you were talking about alternative fuels, Phil, which is something which I think is making a positive contribution. And I think it's a practical way forward, even though maybe it's only a temporary measure. There's been quite a lot in the news about that recently, hasn't
there? Well, do you know what? Barely a week goes by without someone, some construction company or plant hire company, sticking their hand up and saying, we're switching from fossil diesel, regular diesel, to hydrotreated vegetable oil, HVO. And yeah. I must admit, I thought HVO was an alternative to diesel. It's not actually. It is diesel. Obviously, my understanding of what diesel is incorrect. But it's a diesel without any fossil fuel in it. It's a paraffin-based diesel made from waste fats and vegetable oils.
Oh, right.
You know, 100% biodegradable, renewable, sustainable sources.
Yeah, it's a good thing. I think that's a really good thing. You know, you get rid of all those fatbergs blocking up our sewers, for example. Yeah, I didn't know that it was actually a diesel. I thought it was literally just vegetable oil. I literally once, about 5 years ago, maybe longer ago than that, visiting the supermarket, saw a chap come out with a trolley full of Tesco's cheapest vegetable oil. And I watched as he opened bottle after bottle and poured it into the fuel tank of his transit van. I mean, I literally, that's what was happening. And I thought, well, if it's that simple, you know, why aren't we all using vegetable oil instead of diesel? Maybe he failed to drive away on that particular occasion. I don't know. But yeah, so it's actually diesel. It's been treated to turn it into diesel fuel.
Well, okay. I've just Googled diesel as we speak, and diesel apparently is not the fuel itself, according to this online dictionary. A diesel is any vehicle that has an engine powered by oil as a fuel. So if it's vegetable oil, it's a fuel. So it's
sure. Oh, okay. I'm even more confused now.
Yeah, me too. Anyway, HVO is this.
Yeah.
Biodegradable, environmentally friendly fuel that's an alternative to diesel. And everyone, I use that term loosely, but a lot of people are suddenly turning to it. Some names, for example, in recent weeks and months who have had stuff from John Sisk, BAM and Lendlease amongst contractors. Gap Hire, the hire chain, have just finished a two-year trial in Jersey, and said, yep, it works, it's great, and they're rolling it out. Milbank Concrete Products are using it. Cadman Cranes and their mobile cranes. GGR Crane Hire. Fast Flow, the utilities contractor. And the one that's got my attention this week is the National Federation of Demolition Contractors have come out and said that they now expect as in the sense of demand rather than hope for or anticipate, but they are basically have issued a directive to their 140 member companies that they've got to phase out diesel and switch to HVO or an alternative low carbon solution. And they're going to be monitoring their members and expecting that to happen. And what I thought that was interesting was for a trade association to tell their members what to do and how to behave is kind of unusual. A lot of trade associations are shy of doing that. They're a bit more sort of sit back. And I mean, I can't imagine, for example, the Construction Plant Hire Association telling on what to do. They might, the CPA, the Construction Plant Hire Association, I could well imagine producing or publishing research or producing a position paper or advice that's saying, this is what we regard as best practice. But it wouldn't say, if you want to stay a member of this organisation, you've got to do A, B or C.
But the NFDC is like that. And the NFDC has very, very, I'm going to say rigid rules, which is probably not quite true. But they have very high standards, let's put it that way. Because the demolition industry has acquired over many, many years a reputation for being a dangerous industry to work in, they've been very proactive in setting very high standards of professional behaviour and practice and that kind of thing. And becoming a member of NFDC is not necessarily easy. You don't just sign up and you're a member. You're audited. I mean, I think you pointed out to me recently that I think that you still have to be regularly audited. Is it every 3 years?
I think so. I'm not sure what the terms are, but I believe there's an audit process. I could be wrong on that, but that's what I understand. Yeah. Whereas Construction Plant Hire Association, the main reason historically people join is to have access to the contractual terms and conditions.
Yes.
It's a contract publishing organisation at the outset. Yes, it does lobbying and member representation as well. But it doesn't, I mean, for example, if a member of the CPA is found, you know, in breach of the law or bad practice, or, you know, the owner of the company goes to jail for something bad, you don't get thrown out of the CPA. You just, you know, carry on paying your fees, because they don't see that as their role.
No. So I think you're right that NFDC, it's unusual to see them sort of setting out what amounts to a diktat to their members about the sort of fuel they should be using. But I should think if any trade association would do it, it would be somebody like the NFDC. You know, they are. It's almost like a professional organisation. It has, you know, you have to qualify to be a member, and you have to uphold their standards. So I think that's quite interesting. The thing which I found a little bit puzzling about their announcement was that they said that their members will be expected to phase out the use of red diesel on demolition sites and move to HVO. And I thought, well, we've had this discussion already. They're not going to be able to use red diesel anyway. I mean, do they just mean sort of diesel or white diesel or any diesel?
One of there are two contexts to this. One is everything we've been talking about, the climate emergency and everyone trying to get towards net zero carbon and so on. The second is the abolition, the ending of the tax rebate that red diesel currently enjoys. Anyone joining us for the first time, red diesel is the same as any other diesel, but it's coloured red because it means that certain people are allowed to get a tax break to use it. It indicates that that diesel is cheaper because it hasn't got the 47 pence per litre tax, extra tax. So that ends next April, and as we've mentioned, HVO is a diesel like any other, and therefore it is taxed at the same rate as red diesel currently. But there is a hope that, and I don't know what nods and winks the Treasury or the government have given to the industry in this regard, but there is a hope that HVO will have some sort of financial incentive given towards it when the red diesel rebate ends, and that HVO will become cheaper than diesel regular full tax fuel. So I think that's where the use of the word red diesel has been thrown in here to try and say, you know, maybe a bit of almost a dog whistle thing to say, you know, red diesel is going, the tax rebate is going. So I don't know whether HVO is the same price, that, you know, whether you pay the same price at the moment for HVO as for regular diesel.
No, I don't.
I don't
know who produces it either.
Crown Oil.
I haven't really looked into this.
I'm confused between producers and suppliers. I know Crown Oil are one of the big suppliers. They supply regular red diesel and HVO. And there are a few others. Green D Plus is another supplier I've heard quite a bit of, Green D Plus. Green D Plus also supply John Sisk, who have been using it to operate their plant in the big North Stow housing development in Cambridge, near Cambridge.
Oh, right, OK.
So those are two of the big names in HVO. So it seems that over the past year, two, three, I'm not sure, it has become pretty widely available. It's not something where, you know, you don't have to wait outside your local supermarket or Chinese takeaway at the dead of night to see if they got any cast off leftover vegetable oil. You know, there's become an industrial supply chain of the stuff.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I wonder if you'll see it on the garage forecourts. I mean, I haven't seen it coming out of any pumps anywhere. I mean, if I had, maybe I'd have a go.
But you don't see red diesel on the garage forecourts either.
No,
I don't
that's
think it's stuff that, if you're in the business, you have it delivered to your tanks in situ.
Yeah.
But people are installing their own special HVO fuel tanks. It's GGR that recently said that they've got an HVO fuel tank installed at their southern headquarters in Haddenham, and they're getting one put in at their northern base in Oldham as well. And this will become a standard thing, I think. People have their HVO tanks.
Yeah, and this is stupid question time, but you say HVO is a low carbon alternative. So does that mean that it has completely different emissions from sort of fossil fuel diesel? There must be some. We've talked about tailpipe emissions at the tailpipe. Is it different? Presumably, it must be.
Now, I knew you were going to ask me this, so I've looked it up. For every 1,000 litres of regular diesel burnt, you'll produce 3.6 tonnes of greenhouse gas carbon dioxide, compared to just 195 kilograms for every 1,000 litres of HVO burned. So 195 kilograms versus 3.6 tons that's 0.2 of a ton versus 3.6. That's the difference.
You're saying that 3.6 tons of CO2 comes out of 1,000 litres of fuel?
A regular fuel.
1,000 litres?
Yes.
You know, 1,000 litres of fuel doesn't weigh 3.6 tons, it weighs about a ton.
Hey, I'm reading this. Don't ask me too
much. I think that needs clarifying. You can tell folks that Phil and I know nothing about this, but that puzzles me. If you can get 3.6 tons of CO2 emissions by burning 1,000 litres of diesel fuel, where does all that mass come from? That's what I want to know. So if you know the answer to that one, folks, send the answer to podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk and I will read it out next week.
Well, a ton of carbon dioxide must be, I mean, there's no such thing. Can there be a ton of carbon dioxide? It must be a ton.
Yes, of course, yeah.
A ton equivalent unit or something. I mean, carbon dioxide is, I know it's heavier than air, isn't it? Is it?
Yeah. But yeah, yes it is. But gases have mass. You know, and I can remember reading in a very old science book when I was at school that, and this is an interesting comparison, that the average weight of the air inside the weight of air inside an average living room is approximately the same as a sack of coal.
What?
The air inside the room you're sitting in now has the same mass
as a sack of coal.
As a sack of coal, yeah.
I should have paid more attention at school. I find that stunning.
Well, of course, gases have mass. Well, yeah.
Well,
I mean,
they
must.
I accept that. But is air that heavy? Blimey.
Apparently so. But anyway, it still doesn't solve my conundrum. So I'm still a bit puzzled about
anyway,
that.
But HVO, there's still particulate matter and there's still nitrogen oxide emissions. It's just a heck of a lot less
of it.
So it doesn't, it won't kill the move completely towards electric power, towards other forms of traction mm-hmm. for machinery and motor cars and so on. But no, HVO
is
catching on big time. And I suppose it's just wait and see whether there's a tax break for it.
Well, of course, one of the technologies which is supposed to be helping us, well, I don't know, it's not its main selling point, but I'm trying to link to the next topic here, which is that off-site manufacturing is supposed to be also good for the environment as well as safer and better quality and all the rest of it. But it's just like the road to net zero. It's expensive, isn't it?
It's fascinating to me the amount of money that is going in, that's being invested into off-site construction. I mean, we've talked about off-site construction an awful lot, modern methods of construction as opposed to traditional methods of construction. I mentioned before, I'm not keen on the term modern. I don't see what's so modern about making a timber frame in a workshop rather than outdoors. But as you all said, it can mean many, many things. It can mean precast concrete beam poured in a workshop. It can mean a timber roofing frame made in a workshop and shipped to site, mm-hmm. Or it can mean an a complete prefabricated house made in, yeah. indoors, or components thereof. And it can mean yeah. actually pretty much anything, but some form of component that's made indoors, not at point of erection. And the ones that particularly interest me in this are the house building, the people investing in house building. I've had for a long time the kind of people who put up Premier Inns and McDonald's and the yeah. bathroom pods and the system build, structurally insulated panels and all these sort of things. And they've been around for a while, and I don't think there's much new about them. But there are a few new people in the past 2 or 3 years with big money behind them. And I'm thinking of people like Top Hat, Ilkley Homes, who I always want to think of as called Ilkley Homes, but they're not Ilkley.
Yes, I do. I always call them Ilkley Homes.
And annoyingly, they style themselves with a lowercase I at the beginning. So it's almost like, we're like Homes, but not quite like Homes. We're Ilk Homes. Legal and General have got this big factory in near in East York, or east of Leeds, in Sherburn and Elmet. And the other ones are cropping up, Project Etopia. And all, yes. all these new names emerging with big money coming in. Top Hat is Goldman Sachs. Ilkley is private equity firm TDR Capital. Legal and General, we're familiar with that name. It's a big insurance company and pension company. Etopia's Keystone. It was Stanley Fink initially, and Rubin Brothers, and Keystone Capital. So all venture capital is all thinking this is the future. Even though still on the housing side, there are issues. There remain to be issues with the viability of it. So far, social housing is diving into these prefab modular homes quite happily, because it's cheap and quick, and it ticks environmental boxes. But mortgage lenders are being a bit shy because they're not quite sure whether these things have got a design life of 20 years or the sort of 300 or 400 design life that our grandparents built. And so the mortgage market is not yet completely on board, which is the big stumbling point for the new generation of prefabs. But the fact that there's this big money in is fascinating to me. And the news story that I'm putting this conversation on was Top Hat Industries, the Goldman Sachs company, announced they published their financial results for the year to October, 31st of October 2020. And there are actually two Top Hat bits of the business. Top Hat Industries is a manufacturing company, and it made a pre-tax loss of $21.3 million, chicken feed for Goldman Sachs, of course, but loss of $21.3 million on turnover of about $6 million. So the turnover of $6 million, losing $21 million. Any other business would pack up and go home. But this is we've got to remember, it's a startup company with all the startup costs that's involved, and it's basically saying we're gonna speculate to accumulate, effectively, is the old
was term. That their first year of trading, or have they been going for a little while?
It began production in 2018.
Okay.
So it's probably their second full year accounts. Previous accounts, they lost $11 million on turnover of $2.2 million. So they lost £5 for every pound that they generated. Yeah. So that's the kind of, it's still a small business. I mean, a £6.3 million turnover business is no one's idea of big business. But it's got big ambitions. They have ambitions to make thousands of houses a year. Similarly, Legal and General, they want to be making 3,000 modular homes a year by 2024. So there's not yet money in these factory built conveyor belt homes yet, but lots of rich organizations, rich people with presumably brains the size of Belfast, are going to get banking the house on the money coming. Be interesting to see when it happens, though.
Yes, I think It's just as well that they are prepared to put their money where their mouth is, because we've mentioned this before, that offsite has always been hailed as the future of construction. It has so many, we can all recite the various benefits of offsite manufacture. But as you said, the mortgage lenders, and to a lesser extent perhaps the insurance industry, they've effectively got a veto. They can stop the big volume house builders adopting this sort of technology simply by refusing to either underwrite the insurance or lend money in the form of a mortgage. So this is why, for example, the Persimmons and the Taylor Wimpers of this world still build with so-called traditional brick and block, and it's a sort of technology and fabric that the financial world is comfortable with, and so they're quite happy with that, because they know from previous experience that these buildings last. Well, at least some of them do, because as we know, there are some traditionally built houses which are absolute crap and falling down all over the place. But yeah, the insurance industry and the mortgage industry is frightened of anything new, so they don't want to lend against it. Interestingly enough, they're also very chary about things on the other end of the scale. So if you want to build a house with a traditional material like
thatch,
cob, for example, cob down in this part of the world, they will say, "Oh, you want to build a house out of mud? Oh, I'm not sure about that." So it's an awkward and very frustrating situation for people who want to do something slightly different from the norm, and especially when we know that off-site manufacture can be a really good way of building things, particularly houses, domestic properties. It does seem a shame that it is so costly to actually get into this.
Well, the people I feel sorry for are the small people who come up with the ideas and can't make money out of it, because the investment required is so huge, and they get bought out very early on, and the big muscled money people move in, push the ideas person out of the way, and take over, and the little person's nowhere to be seen when the money does finally start rolling in. But hopefully they keep enough in their back pocket, a small percentage ownership, to buy a small yacht at the end of it.
Well, talking about how under normal circumstances any other company making losses of this magnitude would call it a day and try and quit. Well, I was going to say quit while they're ahead, but clearly not ahead. But do you feel, that because organisations like, who are the people behind Top Hat? You mentioned
Top Hat is Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, Goldman Sachs. That because they're behind it, that they can carry on making these losses for the foreseeable future. How long do you think this can go on for?
Well, there are a lot of big organisations, big corporations, who find it expedient to have in various countries of the world loss-making businesses. And if you want to know more about that, folks, talk to your accountant. It can be sometimes useful to lose money.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I suppose it limits your tax liability, for example.
Exactly. That. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, that's an interesting business proposition.
I'm not suggesting Top Hat is deliberately losing money. Second year in business, it's clearly a company that's, in the development stage. It's an expensive, high barrier to entry in this business. I mean, interesting that another one of these prefabbers, a Japanese company called Sekisui House,
entered
the UK in 2019, and I think they're tied up with Boklok, the Skanska IKEA flat packers.
Yes.
Sekisui House in year to January 2019 made a profit of £900 million on £15 billion turnover. Obviously, yen for them.
In Japan,
but
was this?
Worldwide. It's active in USA, China, Singapore, and Australia, as well as Japan.
Oh, wow.
So they're making best part of £1 billion on £15 billion turnover. So,
right.
there is big money in this.
Yeah.
If you get the scale, you get it going, and whatever. And, you know, I'm quite sure that Goldman Sachs, TDR Capital, Legal & General, Keystone Capital are very familiar with what Sekisui House have achieved.
Yeah, interesting. It's nice to see them taking the long view rather than...
No, I agree with that completely.
Rather than adopting a short-termist approach. Do you have any idea what these houses look like? I mean, do they look just normal, or are they a bit wacky in design? Because that can be another thing limiting the appeal of a new technology like this.
No, I haven't. I'm not an expert on these. I would love to start doing a visit of some of these sites when they're up and built and walk around these houses. The CGI animation, computer-generated images that they put out of this is what our development's going to look like, look moderately reasonable, fairly normal. Some of the, I can't remember who it is, but there's one of the prefabs have got a shot of inside the production line of these houses, which looks a little bit sort of, as you might expect, cookie cutter, Lego-y, Wendy House-y. I'm sure they're solid, but you know, if you're building it without variation, it would be a bit like that.
You know, housing associations are far more likely to adopt or explore the possibilities of something like this, because, you know, it's a different sort of model, isn't it? They're in it for the long term, for a start. They're not like, you know, Taylor Wimpey wants to build a house and then sell it as soon as possible, preferably before it's built. You know, they're in for the long haul, and so they will invest in technology like this, and they'll also invest in slightly unusual design. So that offers the opportunity also to experiment with more energy-saving technologies, because, you know, sort of limiting solar gains or using solar heating, that kind of thing. And I think some of the most interesting housing actually built in the UK over the last 20 years or so has been driven by the social housing sector. They're far more willing to experiment and really stick their necks out to try these new technologies and these new designs.
Right. Well, we've talked about modular, modern methods of construction and modular building many times before, haven't we, Dave? And I'm sure
it'll happen again.
We'll come back to it again. I would, before we close, I have a, what I think is a correction. I can't remember, but last week we were talking about the Stonehenge, the A303 Stonehenge tunnel and the legal action there. I certainly, on the Construction Index website, attributed the action brought against Highways England and the Stonehenge tunnel case to the Transport Action Network campaign group. It wasn't them at all. It was, although I think it's an ally of theirs, but the people who actually brought the case was the Save Stonehenge World Heritage Site group. So that they were the complainant in the A303 hearing that happened a couple of weeks ago. So apologies to Save Stonehenge World Heritage Site Group and to Transport Action Network for getting you muddled up. So just to set the record straight, that's who was who in that discussion last week.
Well, is that it then, Phil, for the
I think it is.
Week?
I think we're done. But for another week, David and I have run out of conversation.
I think so, Phil, yes. So we've been talking long enough.
Alrighty. Well, thank you very much, everyone, for listening. But for another week from Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast, that's all we've got. We'll speak to you again next week. But from David and myself, thank you very much and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.